Which book is it?
Nine.
Eight
is so short.
I covered eight last time.
Okay. Eight is one canto?
Yeah, one short canto.
Yeah,
basically, nothing happens there.
Yeah, that's all.
What do you mean, nothing happens?
The last thing said, you mean the death is nothing?
Well, there's like two lines given to the death, and then she's already thinking about something else. Yeah. The death of the body is not the important thing. It's the passage towards what's important. I would like to be sitting in that chair, I'll tell you. That's okay. I'll manage. So, for those of you who haven't been here all along the way, see the pink dot? That's just a proof that what you see is what is.
It's also what you get.
The approach that we're taking is to try to identify patterns and themes and structures from book to book of Savitri, which is not the best way to approach Savitri, and it's definitely not my normal way of approaching Savitri, but we're doing it to get an introduction to Savitri as a whole. And that's difficult to do because it's such a complex thing, if you consider it a book. And if you consider it a mantric yogic transmission, then it's more a matter of a life's work. And so to grasp it as a whole is a very nebulous goal to start with. It doesn't have much meaning. But it has occurred to me in the last couple of years that there are distinct intentions that Sri Aurobindo expresses, and they are identifiable, and they are somehow self-contained in such a way that you can approach Savitri with respect to the Aswapati's yoga, for example, or with respect to the cosmological view of evolution, or with respect to Savitri's yoga, and with respect to fate as a worldview. And so now we are approaching the final cycle, which I've referred to as the yoga of the transformation of death. And it comprises three books, basically. But the three books are a continuous unfolding of this yoga of death. So what I would like to do is, because they're quite long, summarize this book, which is next, tonight, and overlap a little bit with the next book. I hope to do that because book 10 has four cantos and this book has two cantos, and the four cantos of book 10 are all, two of them are very long, and so I'd like to move on past this book tonight. The theme here is the experience of death, particularly this book, the death of the body, the experience of the mind and the soul with respect to the body after its death. Now, it's a very unusual subject for someone to write about. It's not something that we actually know anything about. Or maybe there's a rare individual who has memories of a death experience. But by definition, it is something categorically other than conscious life experience. So it's not something that most people are familiar with, and in fact, most people avoid the subject completely, if possible. And when it occurs, when it comes into one's life, it's a big shock, because it's so different from life experience. So Sri Aurobindo has spent an inordinate amount of consciousness and force to actually narrate this process that takes place after the death of the body. In order for him to do that, I think there can be little doubt that he ventured into that realm for the purpose of this writing and for the purpose of this yoga of transformation of death. And I can hardly believe that he would write a few hundred pages of epic poetry about something that nobody knows anything about just for the sake of filling up pages with beautiful words. So it strikes me, having read these books quite a number of times, that this is a teaching about the yoga of death. And it is a transmission of the experiential reality of the death experience. There is at least one other tradition which has taken this task seriously, and if I may be allowed to refer to Buddhism for a few minutes, I would like to refer to a text which is commonly known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Actually, its title is The Great Book of Natural Liberation Through Understanding in the Between. And the between in that case refers to the time between death and life. But the preparation for that liberation is yoga. It's commonly known as highest yoga tantra. And it entails several betweens. If we practice yoga in life, what we're told in this teaching is basically the same thing that we were told last week in the Yoga of Savitri. There's very little difference, if any. And so the practice is a practice of being conscious between death and life, of being conscious between the sleep state and the waking state, which is the dream state, and being conscious between a waking trance and the waking gross body, which is called the waking magic body, the spiritual body. In trance, we experience going out of our normal state and coming back into our normal state, and in between, we experience spiritual illumination. And sometimes we have thoughts about it, and sometimes we see visions, and I think often, in this case, we feel inundated by subtle energy. So this is the between, this is that between, the trance between. And so there are three betweens. And then actually the waking trance or the sleep state or the death state are also betweens of the other two states. And so all of the nine states may be considered betweens, otherwise known as bardos. So Tibetan Yoga Tantra is the practice of being conscious in all of the betweens for the purpose of liberation from the world of illusion and suffering. And as a result of liberation from ego and illusion and suffering, to bring a force of compassion and wisdom in place of those ordinary states for the sake of the well-being of human beings, of humanity. And so the teaching of the Great Book of Liberation, having to do with death, constantly reminds the practitioner that he or she, yogi or yogini, shouldn't stop at any of the stages of the between. Even the bliss of nirvana, they say, isn't the goal. It is a between state also, whose ultimate object is reincarnation as an embodiment of wisdom and compassion for the sake of others. And so if we remember the Book of Fate and all of the Christian imagery regarding sacrifice as being the real purpose of yoga, sacrifice meaning giving oneself for the sake of salvation, transformation of suffering into bliss, transformation of death into eternal life, transformation of human life into ever-present, luminous wisdom. We can recall that Sri Aurobindo has put a great emphasis in those books And in the beginning of the book of Savitri's Yoga, in the Triple Soul Forces, and especially in the book of Fate and the Triple Soul Forces, but also all the way back into the Yoga of Aswapati, where after his higher mind illumination, he says that what really has to happen is that the nature of things must change and the Divine Mother must bring a force down to do that. It's not enough to just experience liberation. So this theme runs very systematically throughout Savitri. And in the book of Savitri's Yoga, there's a very strong emphasis on living in the state of blissful emptiness, where form and formlessness are realized as the nature of reality. Not form and not formlessness, but form and formlessness are the nature of reality. And that's where we stopped last time. So this thrust of Savitri, both with respect to the yoga, the practice of yoga, which in Tibetan Buddhism is the creation stage, and the passing through death to achieve liberation, the perfection stage, are very, very similar in the two traditions. And one of the reasons why they're similar, a historical reason, is that if we look back at the 8th century and 9th century, when Tibetan Buddhism started to develop full speed ahead and did so for the next 1,000 years, at the same time in India, the tantric Hinduism was practicing all of that and teaching it to the Tibetans. So if we look at some texts from the 8th and 9th century, for example, one which is called the Lakshmi Tantra, we hear all of the mantras of transformation that we hear in Sri Aurobindo's texts. And the stages of the descent of Lakshmi and all of the deities that she brings to birth, and the practices that are done by the yogis to purify and invoke and surrender, and all of these things are here in the highest yoga tantra of Tibet, and they are here in Savitri. We don't need to know that in order to be sadhaks of integral yoga. I merely wanted to mention it to indicate that this tradition, whose purpose is conscious death and conscious rebirth, is a tradition from which both Sri Aurobindo and Tibetan Yoga Tantra derive much of their language and practice and intention. Lakshmi Tantra. Lakshmi Tantra. I think Vladimir should have been given the task of introducing it to us. Because the Veda was another period, and the focus of the Veda is something different. But then after a couple of thousand years, this Vedic practice went through many changes, and this idea of the transformation of the body became the core teaching of Kriya Yoga and so many other systems, you know. So what Sri Aurobindo is doing with Savitri can be understood in the context of some traditions, not just one. And this, I marked a few passages here, but I'll just read one of them from Professor Thurman, Robert Thurman. This is his version. He says, the practice of tantric yoga aims to align and transmute ordinary death, the sleep state, the trance state, into the Buddha truth body. The ordinary between the dream state and the waking subtle state into the Buddha beatific body, and ordinary life, the waking state, and the integrated gross body into the Buddha emanation body. The three stages of perfection, the Buddha emanation body, which is the ordinary life body transformed by wisdom and compassion, the Buddha beatific body, the trance state illumined experience, and the Buddha truth body, higher mind, death state, deep trance. He says, in the context of practices such as those presented in the Book of Natural Liberation, oriented toward preparing for a successful use of the ordinary between state to accelerate progress toward Buddhahood, the processes of the sequence of lives, daily life, and the single lifetime can also be described as the six betweens, the life, dream, trance, death point, reality, and existence betweens. This scheme is used to create in the practitioner a sense that all moments of existence are between moments, unstable, fluid, and transformable into liberated enlightenment experience. The three levels of the body-mind complex are used to provide a framework for Buddhist practitioners to integrate their subtle, contemplative experiences with their ordinary experience. This enables them to alter their habitual self-identification process in order to enter usually unconscious states consciously. Presumably, the most difficult unconscious state to enter consciously is death. Now, some very mysterious things are communicated by Sri Aurobindo in this text. And we'll hear a couple of them tonight. One is the mystery of the union of the goddess, the divine Shakti, and the human soul, Satyavan. You might have noticed that in the whole book of yoga, Satyavan was lying there asleep, and Savitri was doing all the work. And now, after the death moment, in which poor Satyavan hardly even participated, he just suddenly dropped dead, again, Savitri is the one who is conscious, who is going to do all the work. So we need to listen carefully to what the relationship is now in the death bardo between these two entities. It is instructive. There are other similarly instructive things. Another theme, I would say that that's one important theme. Another important theme which builds towards the end of this book and especially throughout the next book is the debate between love, who is Savitri, the divine force, and death, which is the ever-present negation of everything in life. So there's this constant ever-presence of the negation of everything which is being spoken by the voice of death, and there is this constant ever-present immortal love in things which is being spoken by Savitri. So the relationship between those two realities is another theme that we need to pay attention to. And Satyavan represents the one and Savitri the other one. He represents death, she represents eternal life, and he represents eternal death. And a third thing that we need to pay attention to is the trip, the journey. You know, Savitri is an epic in the sense that Sri Aurobindo has used the image of a journey. Pretty much that's the bottom line for an epic. So the journey never takes place outwardly, it always takes place inwardly. And so this journey, this death experience is spoken of as a journey from stage to stage. And if we wanted to give a close reading to this book, we could find parallels between many of the stages. I'll point out maybe a couple of them. And then there is the imagery, and that also is very similar. Sri Aurobindo uses the sun, the moon, the diamond, clarity, the gold, the ruby and the sapphire in ways similar to the ways they are used in the Book of the Great Liberation. So there, and what they do, what the Tibetan yogis do, is build a symbol world that the inner being becomes so familiar with that all of the planes are present in consciousness all of the time. So Sri Aurobindo is building a symbol world that similarly enables us to be in many worlds and many planes at the same time. Therefore, this teaching is not something that one can either summarize or understand very well just by an ordinary reading. It is a profound and thorough preparation for death. And it requires a serious adherence and practice if one is to follow this path. And so as I said in my previous series, Savitri is a path. So I'm going to read a few passages.
May I ask something?
Yeah.
You said that this ancient tantrics in 800, they were doing actually this whole yoga of transformation, including the physical immortality of the body.
That I don't know.
Yeah, that I wanted to ask. Is there any example of people who succeeded in this?
There are stories about people who have succeeded to incarnate and disincarnate, and I mentioned the other day that in Greek tradition you also have those stories. But that's not the same as transforming matter and life and mind into a vehicle of supermind. And so, you know, we read about transformation of consciousness in Buddhist texts, but they mean transformation of the mind into a luminous vehicle. They normally don't mean the transformation of the body into a luminous vehicle, but you know that the Tibetans do practice a physical yoga that is meant to preserve the body for a long time after death and to be able to sit in the snow for weeks without getting cold. And so, I mean, there is definitely the idea of spiritualizing the body, and I don't think it's a very big step from that idea to the idea that reincarnation can have as its objective the manifestation of a new body. And this requires that the spiritual consciousness persuades the principle of death itself to abdicate, to eliminate the principle of death itself from the material world. This is Sri Aurobindo's intention. So in these books, we find Savitri confronting death and confronting liberation and confronting the luminous void and saying to each of these entities repeatedly, that's not my purpose. My purpose is different. And all the way up to the very end, it's a struggle. So if this is the goal, then what is the preparation for this goal? We know what the preparation is for liberation, for the compassionate wisdom body. There is a well-defined preparation, but that is not supramental transformation of the life world. That is living in a liberated consciousness and helping others achieve a liberated consciousness. Its goal is not a transformed material world.
Even one of the example that she once had contact with one tantric yogi. And she had all these experiences of the inner worlds, up to the highest. But she saw it was all a construction only. So from her supramental level, she poked into that construction and she got panicky because he couldn't understand that there's something right coming from higher than he was constructing.
So we can learn from this text a lot of things about the inner experience and purpose of the yoga of the transformation of death. And as we begin to follow this path or to observe some of the aspects of this path, we need to also recognize that we have left behind completely the idea of a story about somebody or about something. It's no longer a story about something if we understand that this is the path of the transformation of death. Then it's purely yoga teaching. And the story aspect disappears almost completely, as it does in Aswapati's yoga, as it does in Savitri's yoga. The story disappears. But there is this relationship, and it's a very subtle thing, between Savitri and Satyavan, which is not in here because of the story. It's in here because we can learn something from that relationship about the soul and the spirit. But we have to listen carefully. Anyway, at the beginning of this book, we have the quite tangible emotional stage. But that tangible emotional stage is an immediate trigger of something else. So that's something we need to note. You know, what's the effect of this experience? So was she left alone. Yeah, some people like to read the words. So was she left alone in the huge wood, surrounded by a dim, unthinking world. Her husband's corpse on her forsaken breast. In her vast, silent spirit, motionless, she measured not her loss with helpless thoughts, nor rent with tears the marble seals of pain. That's what she just spent all that time in the forest practicing. She rose not yet to face the dreadful God. Over the body she loved, her soul leaned out in a great stillness without stir or voice, as if her mind had died with Satyavan. But still the human heart in her beat on. Aware still of his being near to hers, closely she clasped to her the mute, lifeless form, as though to guard the oneness they had been, and keep the spirit still within its frame. Then suddenly there came on her the change which in tremendous moments of our lives can overtake sometimes the human soul and hold it up towards its luminous source. The veil is torn. The thinker is no more. Only the spirit sees and all is known. Then a calm power seated above our brows is seen, unshaken by our thoughts and deeds. Its stillness bears the voices of the world. Immobile, it moves nature, looks on life. It shapes immutably its far-seen ends, untouched and tranquil, amid error and tears, and measureless above our striving wills, its gaze controls the turbulent whirl of things. So in those turbulent moments of our lives, there's an opportunity to become aware of that. And in the agenda, the mother in the last few years speaks often about that center above her, which is completely in control of all her functions, all her thoughts, all her acts. She turns over governance, she says, to that presence above her head.
But the problem is maintaining that state.
Well, there are many problems. That's one of them, for sure. It's the nature of reality. All in her mated with that mighty hour. As if the last remnant had been slain by death of the humanity that once was hers. Assuming a spiritual wide control, making life's sea a mirror of heaven's sky, the young divinity in her earthly limbs filled with celestial strength her mortal part. Over was the haunted pain, the rending fear. Her grief had passed away. Her mind was still. Her heart beat quietly with a sovereign force. There came a freedom from the heartstrings' clutch. Now all her acts sprang from a Godhead's calm. Calmly she laid upon the forest soil the dead who still reposed upon her breast, and bore to turn away from the dead form. Soul, now she rose to meet the dreadful God. Transcended now was the poor human rule. A sovereign power was there, a godlike will. A moment yet she lingered, motionless, and looked down on the dead man at her feet. Then, like a tree recovering from a wind, she raised her noble head. Fronting her gaze, something stood there, unearthly, somber, grand, a limitless denial of all being that wore the terror and wonder of a shape. In its appalling eyes, the tenebrous form bore the deep pity of destroying gods. A sorrowful irony curved the dreadful lips that speak the word of doom. Eternal night, in the dire beauty of an immortal face, pitying arose, receiving all that lives forever into its fathomless heart. Refuge of creatures from their anguish and world pain. His shape was nothingness made real. His limbs were monuments of transience, and beneath brows of unwearying calm, large godlike lids, silent, beheld the writhing serpent, life. Unclasp, it cried, thy passionate influence, and relax, O slave of nature, changing tool of changeless law, who vainly writhest rebellion to my yoke, thy elemental grasp. Weep and forget. Entomb thy passion in its living grave. Leave now the once loved spirit's abandoned robe. Pass lonely back to thy vain life on earth. Wilt thou forever keep thy passionate hold, thyself a creature doomed like him to pass, denying his soul death's calm and silent rest? Relax thy grasp. This body is earth's and thine. His spirit now belongs to a greater power. Woman, thy husband suffers. Savitri drew back, her heart's force that clasped his body still, where from her lap renounced on the smooth grass softly it lay. As often before in sleep, when from their couch she rose in the white dawn, called by her daily tasks, now too, as if called, she rose and stood, gathered in lonely strength, like one who drops his mantle for a race and waits the signal, motionlessly swift. She knew not to what course her spirit above, on the crypt summit of her secret form, like one left sentinel on a mountain crest, a fiery-footed splendor, puissant-winged, watched, flaming, silent, with her voiceless soul like a still sail upon a windless sea. White, passionless, it rode, an anchored might, waiting what far-ridged impulse should arise out of the eternal depths and cast its surge. Then Death, the king, leaned boundless down, as leans night over tired lands, when evening pales and fading gleams break down the horizon's walls, nor yet the dusk grows mystic with the moon. The dim and awful Godhead rose erect from his brief stooping to his touch on earth, and like a dream that wakes out of a dream, forsaking the poor mold of that dead clay, another luminous Satyavan arose, starting upright from the recumbent earth, as if someone over viewless borders stepped, emerging on the edge of unseen worlds. In the earth's day, the silent marvel stood between the mortal woman and the god. Such seemed he, as if one departed came wearing the light of a celestial shape, splendidly alien to the mortal air. The mind sought things long loved and fell back, foiled from unfamiliar hues, beheld yet longed by the sweet, radiant form, unsatisfied, incredulous of its too bright hints of heaven, too strange the brilliant phantasm to life's clasp, desiring the warm creations of the earth, reared in the ardor of material suns, the senses seized in vain, a glorious shade. Only the spirit knew the spirit still, and the heart divined the old loved heart, though changed. Between two realms he stood, not wavering, but fixed in quiet, strong expectancy. Like one who, sightless, listens for a command. So were they immobile on that earthly field, powers not of earth, though one in human clay. On either side of one, two spirits strove. Silence battled with silence, vast with vast. But now the impulse of the path was felt, moving from the silence that supports the stars, to touch the confines of the visible world. Luminous, he moved away. Behind him, death went slowly with his noiseless tread, as seen in dream-built fields, a shadowy herdsman glides behind some wanderer from his voiceless herds. And Savitri moved behind eternal death. Her mortal pace was equaled with the gods. Wordless she traveled in her lover's steps, planting her human feet where his had trod, into the perilous silences beyond. Now, I especially want to read a short passage which comes next. Which is about this relationship which now we see. The silent god grew mighty and remote in other spaces, and the soul she loved lost its consenting nearness to her life. Into a deep and unfamiliar air, enormous, windless, without stir or sound, they seemed to enlarge away, drawn by some wide, pale distance from the warm control of earth and her grown far. From the warm control of earth and her grown far. Now they would escape. Then, flaming from her body's nest, alarmed, her violent spirit soared at Satyavan. Out mid the plunge of heaven-surrounded rocks, so in a terror and a wrath divine, from her eyry streams against the ascending death, indignant at its crouching point of steel. A fierce she-eagle, threatened in her brood, born on a rush of puissance and a cry, outwinging like a mass of golden fire. So on a spirit's flaming outrush born, she crossed the borders of dividing sense. Like pale, discarded sheaths, dropped dully down, her mortal members fell back from her soul. Now, listen to this. A moment of a secret body's sleep. Her trance knew not of sun or earth or world. Thought, time, and death were absent from her grasp. She knew not self. Forgotten was Savitri. All was the violent ocean of a will, where lived captive to an immense caress, possessed in a supreme identity. Her aim, joy, origin, Satyavan alone. Her sovereign, prisoned in her being's core. He beat there like a rhythmic heart, herself, but different still. One loved, enveloped, clasped, a treasure saved from the collapse of space. Around him, nameless, infinite, she surged, her spirit fulfilled in his spirit, rich with all time, as if love's deathless moment had been found, a pearl within eternity's white shell. Then, out of the engulfing sea of trance, her mind rose, drenched to light, streaming with hues. Her mind rose, drenched to light, streaming with hues of vision, and awake once more to time, returned to shape the lineaments of things and live in borders of the seen and known. Onward the three still moved, in her soul scene. So I'll cover a lot of territory next time. I think I'll stop there.
May I say something? If you go a little bit ahead, which may not be really permissible now, but still, at the end we see that death is the Lord, yeah? The Lord in his travesty, in his disguise. And so he doesn't really exist. No? So when we think of this experience of Mata on 13 April 62, where she saw only love, love, love. Death doesn't exist, also doesn't exist. Suffering, sickness, nothing exists. Only love. So we wonder how we can live in this permanent illusion of something which doesn't exist, which is only the divine love. I mean, this is so strange, no? How to get rid of this maya, of this illusion, in which we constantly live. Even if we know it is not true, in our practical life we are constantly supposed to suffer.
No, but it's but the commentary that we had on the Book of Fate says repeatedly that it's not an illusion, this world of death in which we live. That divine love, which is everything, is another plane of this. All the planes are here now. But this is only an illusion in the sense that we don't see the whole reality. So then there are two options. One is to do what she does, and that is merge herself in death with the Lord of Love. That's one option. And the other option is to bring the Lord of Love himself into this to change it. And that's the decision which is made in the Book of Everlasting Day. He says to her, you are me, you are the divine love, I'm the divine love, and we are immortal and eternal. And she says, I'm going back because I want that there. I want your embrace. I want your delight there in the human, not up here in the infinite and eternal beyond life. Life is a plane. The plane of the divine is there.
The first thing we have to merge, we have to completely identify with the divine, and then only we can bring it down. So, I mean, if we still live in the illusion, it means we are not surrendered enough, you know. We still have something of our ego, of our ignorance.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And how to get rid of it is only, it is a process which takes time.
The process of yoga, sadhana.
We support it, we create the suffering, we support it, also our fathers, both heaven and hell. So both parts of ours unchanged, the old resisting, and the superior parts of that together, and this is projected by us. So it is because the soul is a divine, it is a light which can understand why, what are the laws, what are the reasons. And only if we have a soul tangible, if it's guiding us, then we, by our submission, we can understand it by this wisdom, we can slowly suffering.
Yeah, but even here, in this text which we have just read, even though Satyavan was the mortal able to receive the goddess Savitri, he still wasn't aware of what she was.
He was a body.
Well, So the idea that you're discussing is that even after experiencing union with the divine force, the body is still mortal. The life is still going through its daily rounds. People in the world are still suffering. So then the illusion and the reality coexist. And in her consciousness, she sees the union of the mortal and the immortal, the form and the formless, and she maintains that vision, but the thing itself doesn't change. It still requires death, and this whole development of the total union of the two of them in the consciousness of the divine, facing the principle of illusion, the principle of death, the reality of death, not the illusion, but the principle of illusion and the reality of death itself. And what happens is a long, gradual emanation into death itself of that luminous power. And what we will see next is that the very next thing which happens is that she realizes that she is only a pale gleam in that darkness. But even that pale gleam is enough of a sign that there's hope. And then the whole long debate starts to take place until finally the light grows strong enough in the total darkness for the darkness itself to start to dissolve. And even then, it's in that realm. It's in the realm of the divine. It's not in the body. They both just left the body. Now they're somewhere else. And they're going to be somewhere else until the very end. But something's happening in that somewhere else, in that bardo. Something is happening. It's a conscious process which is happening from here all the way till the end. And we'll hear a few descriptions of what that is.
Because we are in between. We are between death and death and the reincarnation. So
I mean, you think this is a problem. What about that absolute darkness which has to be dealt with, which is the other side of reality? And we're in this intermediate zone, you know, neither that luminosity nor death and emptiness. So, like you said, we're in the in between, this in between, but she's going to be in that in between, and it's impossible for us to really understand what that means. But Sri Aurobindo has the power to put us in touch with it.
But you see, the world avatar is only finished when the inconscious is completely transformed. And I think for that we need some cosmic happening, you know. That really the structure of the cosmos, of the matter, will change by divine intervention.
Well, according to Savitri, that's exactly what Aswapati and Savitri were doing.
But what science is doing also.
So the seed, yeah, according to Sri Aurobindo, the seed of that change has been created.
Yes.
Then it's a matter of time for it to evolve.
But
I mean, it's maybe interesting that in 1972 there was a solar maximum of solar spots. Yeah? And so the mother discussed with that friend the possibility that now those who are ready will get the new supramedullary body. Because she said now this energy coming from the sun, which is actually supramedullary.
The problem is nobody was ready.
And that is interesting. I mean, that she could have expected something very concrete to see what's happening in the world. To change matter itself.
No, I mean ready for the body, for the supramentalized body.
I have a question.
Maybe some are ready, I don't know.
I just don't know where I was, so I didn't notice. But does the poem indicate that she makes a choice, or that he makes a choice?
Yeah, we'll hear the choice. And in fact, when the choice is made, is one of the most powerful lines in the whole book.
But I mean an awareness of choice between each of the representations or stages or invitations that come up.
There are a few stages where choices are made, but then there is a kind of ultimate choice.
Because that is the yoga. I mean, that is what is practiced.
The choice is being made all the time.
Right.
But dialogue and death.
Many.
He says, choose.
Right, but the bardos, these creatures, are designed to attract and cast a spell and put a hold on you, or enticing, or, you know, they're promises that are given, they're false promises.
These are small ones.
But she gets offered all.
This is a big one. Yeah. Doesn't do that anyhow. It doesn't need to do that.
There are many small ones that come up also.
Yeah, she gets offered so many. And she says
the main one which she's offered is liberation.
And that's the big choice.
That's the big choice.
And that's what you're saying, the distinction between the Tibetan book.
Yeah.
So the death realizes that she's actually coming from somewhere original source, which he thought he was the source. And then there is a shift of perception. She is the force of the supreme, and the death is an instrument of his work. And that is a huge blunder for the death. I even somewhere wrote what the Lord of Death did not know. In a special article, he didn't know something, that there was this manifestation of the divine was meant.
He thought he was the ultimate power, but didn't realize he was himself an instrument.
At least he behaved.
Isn't that the cause of Maya? That very confusion?
I suggest that you read the book and try to listen to exactly what death is, not in the story, but in itself. Because this is a pretext for a showing of something which is, and that comes between the lines.
All these arguments are seen, showing clearly that he has a problem with this mystery of manifestation. He doesn't accept it fully. He always argues that do you want in this temporary body to have that delight? How dare you to do that? What kind of power you have to be reclaimed? All the time he speaks in this manner, and trying to show that he knows what is meant. And she doesn't know. But then at the end it's something else.
What he says is true.
Yes, every word.
So this is our mind. This is the thing. This is the thing, to listen to exactly the voice of death because that's the way it is. And the voice, all the voices are voices of realities. Thank you for the pink spots.
Would you like to keep it? It's mine as a backup. Thank you very much.
Good, thanks for coming.